Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Adam Ragusea, in for Anthony Brooks.
So, Adam, you know how I like to throw the easy questions at you. how about this one? What is the meaning of life?
Crush your enemies, see them driven before you, and hear the lamentations of the women.
One possible definition of the meaning of life. And how do you measure that meaning? How do you really know?
Well, this is the God's honest truth, Meghna, is that I don't think that there is any intrinsic meaning to life.
But so it just is.
It just is. And so when you ask me about it, I quote Conan the Barbarian, and that's my way of deflecting.
Okay. Well, you know, I can understand that some listeners right now hearing this might think, okay, these are cliched questions. But really, I mean, point me to one person out there who's actually never wondered, what is the meaning of life? I'd say that everyone has.
Indeed. You know,
what is the meaning of my life? And the thing is, we're living in an age where for a lot of people, those questions, aside from Conan the Barbarian, seem to be harder to answer than ever. Which is why a Harvard philosophy professor, his name is Sean Dorrance Kelly, and his colleague Hubert Dreyfus, they put their heads together to offer us a new framework. And it's one that's based in the lessons of literature. And this framework is there to help us make sense of how we engage with what is sacred. That is, if anything is sacred anymore. So, Sean Dorrance Kelly is the chair of Harvard's philosophy department. The new book is All Things Shining, Reading the Western Classics to Find Meaning in a Secular Age. He joins us now. Professor Kelly, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So it is truly a wonderful book, and it kept me quite engaged and busy, actually all this past week when I was on vacation. But let me ask you, you start with a story that you say helps define the problem that we face in modern life today. And that story is the life, the work, and ultimately the death, the suicide of David Foster Wallace. So for people who aren't familiar with who he is, remind us who David Foster Wallace is.
Okay, great. So David Foster Wallace is an American writer who died by his own hand a couple of years ago. He was young. He was 46 years old. He was famous for writing a very big book called Infinite Jest maybe 10 or 15 years ago. And recently in the spring, his unfinished magnum opus called The Pale King was published. He never managed to finish it.
And in fact, I mean, just to sort of put an underscore on this, he was widely considered to be maybe the best and most talented modern writer, postmodern writer, at least coming out of America. He was given a MacArthur Genius Grant, had a huge following, very influential amongst sort of a marquee of other young writers of this age.
Yeah, that's exactly right. He was very well thought of by all sorts of people in the literary establishment. And, you know, he will probably go down as one of the great writers of the late 20th, early 21st century, at least in the American English language. But what makes him great, I think one of the things that makes him great in my mind is the extraordinary ambition of his books. I mean, the books are really incredibly ambitious, not just because they're so long. I mean, they're incredibly long too, but they're really about fundamental issues that have to do with the nature of human existence. And what he's struggling with are the kinds of concerns that characterize contemporary human existence. And he deals a lot, for instance, in his early book with drug addiction, with the nature of entertainment, with the fact that we seem driven to be entertained by things that aren't particularly meaningful or aren't particularly interesting, and yet nevertheless we still find ourselves drawn to them in some way or another. And in general, he's interested in the sort of leveling down of the way in which our lives can matter to us.
Well, so on that point, I mean, here is a writer who has a capacious mind, who, as you say, is drilling down through the multiplicity of layers in modern life. I mean, your first chapter is all about how we are so overwhelmed by choice that we don't really know what direction to go in. And yet, I mean, he did suffer from depression for much of his life, severe depression, and he committed suicide. Yeah. There was likely, we can't deny, there may have been a biochemical
Absolutely.
Sort of backdrop to his untimely death. But you still call his the lesson in his life as the canary in the coal mine of the problem that we face today. Now, why?
Ah, good. Well, it's the canary in the coal mine precisely because of the way his life ended. I mean, what we're interested in is the idea that his great goal as a writer, and in some way I think probably his great goal as a human being, was to be able to articulate a conception of human existence and of what we could be aiming at in a life his readers would find appealing and would find as a kind of salvation, that they would experience as something that makes them feel better about themselves and about what they're aiming at. And I think there's some indication that he felt as though he wasn't able to do it. And what's interesting about his not being able to do it is that we argue the reason he wasn't able to do it is that he's got in the background at least one part of him. He's a very complicated writer, but one part of him seems to have in the background a philosophical conception of what it is to be a human being and what it is for human lives to matter that we argue in the book is a bad philosophical conception.
And that conception, and correct me if I'm wrong, your interpretation of that conception that David Foster Wallace has was that in order to achieve some form of excellence, you almost had to achieve a godlike state. I mean, that you had to have a force of will that would be able to project a sense of perfection everywhere you go, in every experience that you had. I mean, you quote a commencement speech that he gave at Kenyon College, right? And where he was sort of talking about how in order to find meaning in life, even when you're standing in line at a grocery store and there's someone horrible in front of you and you can't stand listening to them and there's seems like 100 people in line, it's not moving, it's the worst day ever. So he says, even in those moments, you can find excellence. And it's a really compelling passage. So if I could quote, you're quoting him, but he says, if you learn really how to pay attention, it will actually be within your power to experience a crowded, hot, slow, consumer hell-type situation as not only meaningful, but sacred, on fire with the same force that made the stars, love, fellowship, the mystical oneness of all things deep down. Now, when I read that, I say, why not? I mean, why isn't it within my power to decide to experience grace in everyday life?
Well, okay, I think that's a great question. What I think, what we argue in the book, is that it's not in our power because some things are just bad and some things are just good. And they don't get to be good and bad by virtue of your having decided that they're good and bad. That's really the background philosophical conception that's at work here in this part of Wallace's work. He's really committed to the idea that something, a situation, an event, something that happens to me in my life is going to get to be meaningful and going to get to have the meaning that it does simply and solely in virtue of my deciding that it's got that meaning. And what we claim is that that's a radical break with everything that's gone in the history of the West, and that it's a conception of what it is to be a human being that's a peculiarly modern conception. It says the world isn't meaningful. If it has meanings, then it gets them because I decide it's got them.
So you're challenging the supremacy of human self-regard.
Well, what we're challenging is the supremacy of human freedom and human autonomy, which is to say the supremacy of the human capacity to determine what any situation means. We think that situations sometimes, occasionally, come to them with a meaning that you don't experience yourself as having given them, and that that's a really important thing to be able to pay attention to, and that once you learn to pay attention to them, all sorts of things to that phenomenon, all sorts of things are opened up to you. So, for instance, you can learn to be grateful that the situation has got the meaning that it does, or you can learn to allow yourself to be guided by the meaning that's in the situation, and that's not a possibility on Wallace's view.
Well, and you write that in the case of Wallace, one of the reasons why you believe he did actually live with such misery within him is because while he wanted to achieve that state where his will could accomplish, what he wanted to be, the greatest writing, that he couldn't. He could not be perfect, essentially.
He couldn't, and he couldn't articulate in a way that would be convincing to his readers what it would be like to be a person who could be perfect in that way. So it's interesting. His last book, which has now been published, I haven't read it. It's an unfinished thing. Parts of it were published when we were writing the book and in various venues. The last book is a bizarre book. It's called The Pale King, and its ambition is to tell a story about a group of characters. The central feature of whose existence is that they live this incredibly boring life.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wants to write a 1,000-page book about people whose lives are extraordinarily boring.
And yet within the confines of that boredom, they find excellence.
Right, exactly what they are. They're IRS tax examiners, and they're going over other people's tax returns. And the question is, how do they deal with that? How do they give to what is essentially a really boring task a kind of meaning that allows them to experience it as a light with the love that makes all the stars go.
So David Foster Wallace, in your book, helps us sort of identify the problem that we're faced with in the modern age. You look to Homer, Dante, Aeschylus, Melville as authors and works of Western classics that may help us find a way towards a solution. And I want to get to that in a little bit. But first, I want to throw out some questions to our listeners who are probably sitting back and scratching their heads and thinking, so how is it that I find meaning in my life? So listeners, I mean, when you think about the books that you read that help you understand the world, the literature that you engage with that helps you look upon the sacred and live with it, what books are those? And why is it that you think we need such literature to really serve as a ballast to steady ourselves in the modern, choice-ridden world that we live in? So give us a call and let us know what you read and why to give you purpose in life and to inspire you. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, Sean Dorrance Kelly, you do talk about a lot of other authors, but there's two that I want to focus on in the time that we have. And the first is Homer. You go all the way back to the Greeks. What does Homer tell us about how to find meaning in the world?
Homer's a really interesting case because if there was a Homer, we don't know who wrote down these books. But the stories of Homer come from maybe the 8th century or 9th century B.C., before the Common Era, and when you read them, they're often read in high school. The Odyssey, the Iliad, they're often read in early college. They're very readable books, and when you read them, one of the things that seems to make them readable is that the characters in them seem familiar to us. I mean, for most purposes, they seem like us. I mean, they seem like the kind of people that we could be or that we could aspire to be or that our friends could be or that we could run across. And yet, there are things in Homer that are really bizarre. Like, for instance, it often happens that when characters, the most admirable characters in Homer, are operating at their best and being the best version of themselves, Homer says that a god came down and guided them. And, most of us have a hard time understanding what that could mean. And what we try to do is we try in the book to find in our everyday existence experiences that if you were living back in Homer's time, you might naturally describe in that way. And we say, actually, if you start to look very carefully, there are quite a lot of these kinds of experiences.
Can you give us an example? Because and the one I'm thinking of in particular is the one you write about of Helen of Troy.
Ah, okay, good. So Helen of Troy is an interesting case. This is one... let me back up and tell a little bit of the story of Helen. So Helen, of course, she's married to the Spartan prince Menelaus, and one night they have a house guest, named Alexander, Paris, and he comes by, and they run off together, and that's how the Trojan War begins. After the Trojan War, the Greeks win, and Helen goes back with Menelaus, and they're having a dinner party one night, and everyone's sort of fawning over Helen. They've fought for 10 years over her. She's the most beautiful woman in the world. She seems to be able to do no wrong, and they're at this dinner party, and she says, you know, I think we should entertain one another. Why don't we tell stories about the great war? Let's tell some stories about Odysseus and the other great warriors. She says, I'll tell one. You know, there was this night when I was hosting a dinner party, and there was this really handsome guy, Paris. And
you heard of him,
yeah,
Paris.
You've heard of this guy. And, you know, I ran off with him, and, you know, Aphrodite shed her light upon the situation, she says, and I ran off with him. And if you're reading—
And then starts the Trojan War.
That starts the Trojan War. And if you're reading carefully, you ought to be thinking, who thought that was an appropriate story, right, to tell in front of your first husband who you're back with?
And yet Homer, in his conception of this, isn't looking down on her. And that's why I want to understand, why is that something that caught your attention?
That's what we're interested in. What does he see in this aspect of Helen that makes him think that she might be an admirable person? And what we argue is that what he realizes is that, or what he believes, sort of background conception of human excellence, is that you can't be an excellent human being by deciding what you need to do in order to be the most excellent human being in one situation or another. Human excellence occurs, he says, when you experience your choice as given to you from without rather than deciding upon it yourself.
So, if we can for a moment, I want to take a step back on this issue of human excellence, because when I look at your bio, I find that, yes, you are the chair of the philosophy department at Harvard, but that is not where you got your start.
That's right.
You got your start somewhere completely different.
Yeah,
searching for maybe a way to mimic or replicate human excellence.
Yeah, that's right. My background was in mathematics and in computer science, and I did a lot of work in artificial intelligence, and I think sort of retroactively, I can understand that what I was interested in is the question, what's special about us? And I had this idea that it was our intelligence. And I sort of thought that if you could build one of those, an intelligent creature or something, then you'd understand what our intelligence is made of. And what I kept on feeling over and over and over again was that every time I built something, no matter how clever a thing it ended up doing, it wasn't all that interesting to me. It didn't really seem to tell us much about human intelligence. And so I started to wonder why that's true, or it didn't really tell us much about what's special about us as human beings.
What did you think was missing?
I didn't know. That was the question. I had no idea. It just left me cold. I would build a program, or I would build a robot or something like that. It would do something, even if it was something sort of sophisticated and interesting. It continuously felt as though I hadn't learned anything about me. I just learned something about how to build a clever thing that did clever things, but it wasn't related to me in any way. So I became interested in this question, why is that? What could it be that's special about us?
Well, could it be that as human beings, part of what we have to do to find meaning is to come to terms with the fact that there is much that is unknowable?
Well, that's part of what we argue, actually. So what we argue, and this comes about not only in Homer, but also in Melville, in fact, in all of the texts that we look at, except for the David Foster Wallace text. I mean, the modern conception is that what there is knowable. And if it's knowable, it's knowable by us. And our job then is to know about it. And what you find in all of the literature before the modern era is a real resistance to that, a real resistance, or the literature that we look at any rate, a resistance to the idea that we could come to know everything that there is to know about the world. And it's not just that they're unambitious. It's that they really think it's important that we couldn't come to know everything about the way about what there is to know about the world.
But this is, I want to come back to this because that flies completely in the face of, I think, a certain set of assumptions that we have as modern 21st century Americans in particular. But we do have a number of listeners who want to join us. We are speaking with Sean Dorrance Kelly. He is the chair of the philosophy department at Harvard University. He is the co-author of All Things Shining, Reading the Western Classics to Find Meaning in a Secular Age. So let's start in Brockton, where David is calling. You're on the air, David.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. In terms of ancient literature, I've read a couple of things that are kind of in counterpoint to what the author there is stating. I believe he's a Greek philosopher, Epictetus, said that things in themselves do not bother people. It is their judgment about the things. And Shakespeare wrote, there is nothing good or nothing bad, except thinking makes it so. So on a more modern note, Joseph Campbell said that people who seek a meaning of life are more accurately seeking an experience of being alive, the sense of the beauty of the world, the beauty of the self, without an outside meaning, that just being and being alive and being a human is enough.
So, David, are you saying that idea that we can find meaning just by the sheer fact of our existence is satisfactory to you as well?
It is, and I think when I hear about so many people struggling to find other meaning, whether it be in a religious group or some other sort of social group, seek meaning outside of themselves. I've also studied some Taoist and other Chinese literature, and that all says that the only true meaning comes from within.
David, thank you so much for your call. Let me let Sean Dorns-Kelly respond.
Well, it's certainly true that there's a tradition of thinking that the only true meaning comes from within. And there's a sense in which we're not against that. We do think that you have to do an awful lot of work on yourself. You have to cultivate in yourself a lot of skills to be able to recognize what a particular situation calls for. But what we're interested in is that at the moment in which you're doing the most excellent thing that you're doing, you experience it not as a decision that comes from you, but as something that's drawn out of you. Okay, if I could give a quick example
Please
of that.
Do.
I mean, one of the kinds of examples that we use in the book a fair amount are sports examples. And I think these are sort of tractable examples. They're not necessarily examples of human excellence full stop, but they're a certain kind of human excellence. And when great athletes find themselves doing extraordinary things, quite often you'll hear them report about it afterwards in something like the following terms. They'll often say, well, yeah, it's not like I decided to make that pass instead of the other pass. I didn't even experience myself doing it at all. It was only after the fact that I noticed that, boy, that was a great pass I made, and it was in fact the only one that could have been made. Or you hear great athletes say that. You hear people in heroic circumstances say that kind of thing. And I think I don't think they're being humble. I think they're being honest. I think that quite a lot of the time when we find ourselves acting in extraordinary ways in domains that we're comfortable in, say the domain of athletics if you're a great athlete, or some other, the culinary domain if you're a great chef, whatever the domain is, if you've got lots of skills, when you find yourself doing the most extraordinary thing, quite often you don't experience the decision to act as having come from yourself. You experience it as what the situation imposed upon you, something that had to be done, and you were just there to recognize that it had to be done. And that's now you have to do a lot of work on yourself to become the kind of person who can recognize those things. So it's not as though we all just get to do it for free. There's a sense in which we're involved, but the sense in which we're involved isn't the sense that Wallace wanted, that we get to decide arbitrarily and willy-nilly what the meaning of the situation is going to be. We have to be receptive.
So that brings us to the author which you sort of close your book with, and the book is All Things Shining. The author, of course, is Herman Melville, and you talk a lot about Moby Dick, and you know, you were talking about the force of will and our drive that you challenge to understand everything and to presume even that we can know and understand everything. And of course, the central character in Moby Dick who says, "I shall find the answer at all costs," is Captain Ahab in his pursuit of the white whale. So, I mean, Moby Dick has long been considered, I mean, even Melville wrote about it, it's a book that thrashes about with Christian themes. So what is it that you find that's so hopeful in characters like Ahab when you're saying that, hey, we can't actually know everything. We cannot find the answer.
Oh, good. Well, this is a point for a clarification. We don't think Ahab is hopeful. We think Ahab is the death of civilization. He's the end of the culture. The hopeful person is Ishmael. He's the narrator of the novel. And Ahab is a kind of fanatic. And the way we read the story, Ahab, his quest to find the ultimate meaning of the universe by having this face-to-face confrontation with the whale, that quest, the way he pursues it, is a kind of fanaticism that, in Melville's version of the story, ultimately brings down the entire tradition of the West, both the Judeo-Christian version of it and the Greco-Roman version of it. You get this extraordinary scene where the Pequod goes down and it takes with it all these symbols of the history of the West, from the archangels to the Roman things and so on. And then he ends the whole thing saying that there's a new flood, and Ishmael is the only one who survives this new flood, and his way of life is the way forward. So Ishmael is the one that's hopeful. And what Ishmael gives us is the recognition that sometimes it's really true that we get in these melancholy moods. The story begins with the damp, drizzly November of his soul, and he offers a way out of that by, he says, luring back the merry May Day gods of old, and that's what we're interested
in. So, if I might, in the last few minutes we have, I would like to sort of bring us around to helping us find answers as to actually maybe how we should be living our lives, but also poke you a little bit, because, you know, you close the chapter on Moby Dick by sort of offering an interpretation of what maybe Melville's trying to tell us, and you say, quote, you know, you should find polytheistic truths for yourself, live in them, find joy in them, even in sorrow, but in these joys and sorrows, rest content with the thought that they give meaning to our world. Now, the idea that it's up to us to find these joys and sorrows, the fact that it's up to us, does that not bring us back to the conundrum presented by David Foster Wallace, who said, yeah, it is the self that's going to find the answer?
Yeah, well, okay, good. So except with this difference. The difference is that what Wallace wanted was not for us to find the answer, but for us to give the answer. He wanted us to make a decision about what the meaning of every situation was like, and make a decision that it was going to be a perfect situation, and in making that decision, be able to experience it as perfect. And we think that's just unhuman. That's not really an option that we have. So what we have to do instead is develop the skill to recognize what meanings are already there in the situation and become attuned to them. That's a different kind of cultivation of the self.
I always leave the maybe unanswerable questions for the end, but how do we become attuned to them?
Oh, I think that's a great question. And I don't really have an answer in 30 seconds, but I can tell you this. I think that one of the main ways to become attuned to them is to find domains that you naturally respond to, and I can't tell you what they are, only you can tell you what they are. Find domains that you naturally respond to and cultivate the skills for recognizing distinctions of worth in those domains. So if it's the domain of music, either listening or composing or playing music, then develop the skills for doing those things. And in developing those skills, you begin to be able to recognize what counts as good versions of the thing you're aiming at and what counts as less good versions of the thing that you're aiming at. And when you recognize that, when you really recognize that, it comes to you with a force that you can't deny. And that's the kind of thing that I think a lot of people are lacking, precisely because they don't do the work to cultivate the skills required in the domains.
Well, Sean Dorrance Kelly, chair of the philosophy department at Harvard University and co-author of All Things Shining, Reading the Western Classics to Find Meaning in a Secular Age. A true pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me, Magna.
Well, we've got to take a break, but when we come back, we launch our Zip Code Stories series, and we'll ask for your writing about your neighborhoods. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Adam Ragusea today. This is Radio Boston.